Introduction. For more than 20 years, I have studied the physical workings of the body as a research scientist and medical school professor. My specialty is neuroscience, the structure and function of the brain, spinal cord, and nerves. My personal research has focused on the dynamic interplay between the brain and the pituitary gland in the control of reproduction. Basic science, experimental studies, laboratory research, hard data and their analyses have been the center of my professional life. Yet, in the past several years, an amazing thing has happened. My research lab at Tufts University School of Medicine in Boston became more than a temple of science. I discovered it to be a temple of the human spirit as well. I began to see in ways that went beyond everything I had been taught and everything that I was teaching in my courses in medical neurosciences, that the physiological processes of the body, interactions within and between individual cells, organs, and systems, has significance beyond human physiology, beyond the physical plane altogether. I began to see that fundamental human truths, a prima even, for living an authentic and self-fulfilling life, were written in the cells, spelled out in the synapses, outlined in the interactions between the body's organs and organ systems. The basic science I knew opened like a flower, and I became more than the research scientist, professor, and administrator I had been. Cellular wisdom is a window into the truths I discovered, the lessons that our body can teach us about the basic principles on which the human spirit operates and moves and breathes. It shares the aha understandings that emerged for me about how to live our lives, the principles that are implicit in the biological principles of human neuroscience. It reveals the body's cellular wisdom, the life lessons implicit in the secret language of the body. My understanding of the body and its processes shifted in these past few years, taking on unfamiliar shapes, beginning even to shine and pulse with new meaning. Cellular wisdom continues to bring a new awareness of previously unseen promise, fresh ways of viewing the fundamentals of one's life, one's relationship with self, and relationship with others. Stepping off into space. It was the summer of 1996. My husband and I had both given scientific talks at an international conference on hormones, brain, and behavior in Turin, Italy. I had delivered a paper detailing my research into the mechanisms governing neuronal interactions in the reproductive cycles of female rats. We were on the way to Rouen, France, where we would attend another international meeting and give another set of presentations. The neuroscience paper I was scheduled to present in a few days was research-based and abstruse. For the moment, however, we were on holiday, touring the lush green French countryside. We had stopped for the night at the Hotel Beau Site in Talois. At dinner that evening, in the candlelit dining room, I overheard a young English-speaking woman telling her husband how terrified she'd been watching him parasail that morning. The word parasail reverberated in my consciousness. I'd always been fascinated by the sight of people floating beneath colorful, billowing sails suspended high in the air. Something clicked inside of me, and I said to my husband, "There's parasailing here. Before we leave tomorrow morning, I want to try it." My husband looked at me as though I had gone mad, and I guess in a way I had. Generally, I'm paralyzed by heights. Moreover, I can't swim. Neither of us could visualize my actually jumping off a cliff and sailing into the air over Lake Annecy. Yet, something inside me told me I had to do it. I needed to perform a daring action to demonstrate that I was ready to break free of my old way of being. Why was I compelled to do this crazy thing? I was a respected neuroscientist with a long list of publications to my name. chair of the Department of Anatomy and Cellular Biology, and director of a research center at Tufts University School of Medicine. I had reached what many would call the pinnacle of success. But I felt overwhelmed by the demands of running a large university department, juggling three budgets, and responding to the exacting requests of three deans while maintaining an active research lab. Often, I felt caught between what my head told me had to be done for the good of the department and what my heart told me the faculty would feel about the changes I, as an administrator, was forced to make. More than once, returning home after an exhausting and contentious day, I spent the evening in tears. Academia had been my home. It was more than a job. It was a way of life. Teaching, research, and giving talks at scientific meetings like the ones on this trip were all I knew. Consequently, when thoughts of leaving that life entered my head, I berated myself. Who would be foolish enough to leave a tenured professorship? Yet everything I had learned about neuroscience was telling me that it was time to make a change. I had seen in the laboratory that the smallest building blocks of life, the cells, which make up the organs and systems of the body, direct their activities from a centrally located nucleus. I had come to believe that this same principle, that living systems function by directing their activities from their core, applies to life at every level. I knew that without question, if I did not begin to live from the center of my being, I would collapse or explode from the tension. And so at 5 the next morning, we drove to the top of the mountain, Le Col de la Faucleuse, overlooking Lake Annecy. My husband was humoring me, I guess, figuring I'd back out at the last minute. I scrunched down in my seat, barely daring to look out of the car window at the view below. As I suited up at the site, I asked the man in charge, "Are people afraid to do this?" "Lady," he replied, "anyone who hasn't done this before is afraid." I took a deep breath, closed my eyes, and ran toward the cliff. Suddenly, the air swooped under my sails. I was lifted into the air. I had let go of the earth, yet invisible forces still supported and guided me from the moment I untethered and stepped off into space. That day was September 1, 1996. Exactly 1 year later, I untethered again. I resigned my position as department chair and took a sabbatical, which I then extended by a year's leave. I was flying toward an unknown future in which science, in a way I could not yet see, would direct my activities from the core. Invisible forces under my wings would have to show me the way. Biology as a source of wisdom. My first hint that the principles of hard science held the keys to human mysteries came in the early 1970s, when I was a graduate student at Tulane. I had been taught that neurons, the cells which make up the brain and spinal cord, were the most stable cells in the body. The neurons of an adult animal might die, but they did not change their structure. Yet, as I peered through an electron microscope at the neurons of the brains of adult female rats I was studying, I saw regular cyclic variations within individual cells. Organelles, miniature organs within the cell, appeared to appear and disappear in a regular and repeatable pattern over a 4-day period. I tried to discuss these findings with my professors. The response was always skeptical. "Expand your sample," I was told. "Do more animals." Experimental research involves months of time. Time to breed animals, time waiting for them to be born and to reach puberty, time to take vaginal smears over several months to determine when they establish regular estrous cycles. Then, there were sampling days on each day of the cycle, preparing the tissues, cutting brain sections thinly enough for an electron beam to penetrate, examining multiple sections in exactly the same region of the brain, taking photographs, developing the images, analyzing the data. All of this that I could not know what the research would show until it was finished. I did more animals. The results were the same. Convinced I was seeing something that other researchers had overlooked, I began to speculate about what might be causing the organelles to appear and disappear. I had injected one group of female rats in my study with the male hormone testosterone when they were 5 days old. As I expected, my tests showed that these rats had abnormal ovaries and were incapable of cycling. The mysterious organelle I was studying was apparent in their brain samples. I ran the same test on a control group of rats whose estrous cycle was normal. Their brain samples also showed the organelle, but with a significant difference. The organelle appeared and disappeared at regular intervals. Not only were the rats' ovaries affected by early exposure to a hormone, but their brains were different too. In normal adult animals, I was forced to conclude the physical structure of the cells of the brain can change. The brain, as science describes it today, is plastic. The implications of what I was seeing were profound. If the brain is malleable, even this most stable aspect of our physiology, can change in response to changing conditions. Under the microscope, I had seen neuronal changes in response to the wash of ovarian hormones triggered during the monthly reproductive cycle. But what other conditions might cause changes? Does the brain change physically, for example, when hormones are removed or altered during menopause? What about other life events? What changes might they trigger? I was aware, of course, of the dynamic principles that guide interactions between other organs, such as the heart, liver, kidney, and between organ systems, such as the digestive and circulatory systems. Organs and organ systems retain their high level of responsiveness by changing, by turning off and turning on in response to condition. If an organ were to remain stuck in the on position all the time, its sensitivity would decrease. And soon, it would lose its ability to respond. This is also true of neurons, which are only on when they are actually conducting an impulse. I did not imagine, however, that this principle might influence physical structures within neurons. To what extent, I asked myself, is life at every level malleable, plastic? Patterns repeated on many levels in the body usually indicate the presence of a basic underlying mechanism. Key principles are obvious in many different circumstances, at many different levels of the body's functioning. Take, for example, the principle that information flows from the interior of a cell to its outer reaches. The same pattern is repeated in the way instructions pass from the interior of a population of cells to cells on the periphery. Moreover, the principles underlying this pattern, that guidance originates from the center, can be seen everywhere in the body. Could it be, I wondered, that this pattern holds true in the larger mechanisms of personal and social interaction as well? Could it be a principle that we might follow to make our lives happier and more fulfilling? I began to ask questions that pointed beyond my research in the lab toward the principles that direct these larger life processes. How might we, like the physical components of our bodies, learn to change as a result of changing conditions so that we maintain our sensitivity and our ability to respond? Could the physiological truths of biology, the way cells and organs and organ systems operate, hold important lessons for how we live our lives, how we think and feel and make decisions? Most important, could biology be a source of wisdom that we might tap into for guidance? Change from the center. Looking back, it's clear that my life up to this time had prepared me for these speculations. Experience had taught me that the ability to respond from one center to changing conditions is essential to optimal functioning. Immediately after high school, I had entered a convent of Dominican sisters in New Orleans. When I joined the order, I told the sister interviewing me that I love science and had wanted since childhood to find out what makes people tick. The order did not deem psychology, my first choice of college majors, appropriate. Instead, the sisterhood sent me to study chemistry, biology, and earth sciences at St. Mary's Dominican College in New Orleans. Later, I went to Florida State University to study nuclear chemistry and physics. As soon as I completed my studies, I began teaching at St. Mary's. The pace of my academic and religious life was unforgiving. Up every morning at 5 for chanting and meditation. Then, off to my 8 o'clock class. By 5, I was back at the convent for more chanting, dinner, and evening prayers. During the after-dinner recreation period, I was often too exhausted to speak. Long before lights out at 10, I was asleep. Summers were equally hectic as I was sent off to graduate courses at various institutes and universities. Clearly, the system of my life was stuck in the on position. I was in danger of losing my sensitivity and my ability to respond. Though some days I felt like I was running a race I couldn't win, it never occurred to me that I could leave the convent. Then one night, during an animated conversation in which I expressed my unhappiness with the unbending rules of the convent, one of the sisters said to me, "Well then, if that's the way you feel, why don't you leave?" That night, after lights out, her words reverberated in my mind, gaining momentum through the night. Finally, it dawned on me, change, fundamental change that would alter the very structure of my life was possible, even necessary, if I wanted to stay vital and keep growing. By the next morning, I was dancing around my room with a new chant on my lips. I can leave. I can leave. I can leave. When I told the Mother Superior that I would be leaving at the end of the semester, she was astonished. I was an excellent teacher and had been an exemplary nun. 11 years after entering the convent, I left. Within a year, I began to study psychology and neuroscience, earning a master's degree at the University of New Orleans and a PhD in neuroscience from Tulane. After postdoctoral studies, I was hired as an assistant professor at Tufts University in Boston and began teaching neuroscience to medical students. I found that I enjoyed simplifying the principles of the brain's functioning so that students could readily understand them. My lab research at Tufts also focused on uncovering the parameters underlying the brain's operations. I probed the principles that directed the activities of individual neurons and neurons linked in circuits. I selected a particular set of neurons to study. My neurons synthesized a hormone that controlled the pituitary gland. That hormone, luteinizing hormone releasing hormone, or LHRH, acted on the pituitary gland, causing it to secrete another hormone, luteinizing hormone, or LH. For months, my research associates and I meticulously mapped and recorded the position of each neuron that made LHRH in the brains of the lab rats. We color-coded the neurons according to different conditions. Viewing them on the computer screen, cells that made LHRH during one condition would show up green, those that made the hormone during the second condition would be red, and those producing LHRH during a third condition would be blue. After months of work, we entered the final keystrokes and began to view the results. On the screen before us, we saw a three-dimensional model of the LHRH synthesizing neurons. Much to our surprise, the neurons in the center of the brain were white, even though this was not one of the colors we had coded. Surrounding the white cells were others that were distinctly red, green, and blue. Each of the colored cells showed up in one of the conditions, but not in the others. Then we got it.
The central cell showed up as white because white is the combination of red, green, and blue. The white cells in the center of the brain seem to be activated in all conditions. Could it be that the neurons in the center of the population were like a light switch, turning on other neurons as needed? Body systems also have control central mechanisms. For example, the brain controls the nervous system, the heart, the circulatory system. The job of the central control center is to provide a seamless flow of information to coordinate activity within a cell, between cells, and between organs and systems. Without such control centers, communication breaks down, vital functions do not take place, and disease or death results. Is this also what happens when we operate from fragmented pieces of ourselves rather than from our core? The elegant mechanisms of the body underscore that to be healthy and whole, we must live our lives from the core essence of who we are.
The body's secret language. The research work I was doing in the lab simply wouldn't stay there. It kept spilling over into my life. I thought about a friend who had recently confided that she was leaving her husband of many years. Pushed by her father to excel in business, this woman had become a top financial planner. The man she married had a similar drive for success, and the couple built a life focused around their high-powered careers. Then, suddenly, the structure of my friend's life began to crumble. No longer able to endure the pain of dragging herself to work each day, forcing her mind to focus on how to make her rich clients more and more money, she left her secure position in a respected investment firm. Wanting to help people, ordinary people, understand how to leverage their income, she started her own small consulting business. One change led to others, and within a year she had decided to separate from her husband. Why, I wondered, did both her first career and her personal life dry up at the same time? Could it be that she had been living her life from the periphery and not from the core? I could not help but compare my friend's story to what I had seen in the lab. Once I began to see the pattern, I noticed it everywhere in my life, in the lives and experiences of my friends, and in the ways we all interacted with the institutions, corporations, and social organizations in our lives. I began to believe that the principles that operate in the body can be meaningful guides to constructing authentic and self-fulfilling lives. I thought, for example, about the fact that many organizations become increasingly ineffective over time. I wondered if this diminishment was related to the loss of a core vision. Steve Jobs catapulted Apple computers into the mainstream of American schools and homes in the 1990s. Not too long after Jobs left the company, Apple computers almost died. Jobs returned, and despite dire predictions, Apple once again soared to prominence. As members of an organization, each with their own agenda, begin pulling the organization in directions that are not aligned with its vision, the energy of the organization's original focus dissipates and effort fragments. Eventually, the organization breaks down. It is as if the animating spirit of the institution has dried up and the institution can no longer thrive. My own life corroborated my speculations. The multiple demands of my professional life as a teacher, researcher, and university administrator seemed to be fragmenting me, strangling my creativity, drying up my spirit from within. I spent my sabbatical and the year-long leave that followed thinking and writing about these issues. I wanted to get to know myself again. Who was I underneath my achievements, skills, and competencies? What did I really want out of my life? Where did I want my life to go? As a part of this process, I consulted with a personal and professional coach. She encouraged me to ask myself difficult questions and to formulate a plan for rekindling my passion for life. After 18 months of hard thinking, my path was clear. I had looked inside and consulted my core values. They pointed me towards starting a coaching business of my own, through which I might help others rediscover how to live exuberantly from the center of their being. I called my business Beyond Success to indicate that success was not the answer to the yearning of the spirit. As a coach, my specialty would be teaching people to apply the dynamic principles of biology and physiology to their personal struggles and to their interactions with others. My training in the laboratory gave me many ideas about how to proceed. I organized a focus group to test the principles I was formulating. Time and again, my living room research bore out the validity of the methodology I was developing. I recall one evening when the topic of fear seemed to dominate the conversation. I described to the group one way that animals handle fear. If you turn an animal quickly on its back, it freezes, I said. The condition is called tonic immobility. One of the group members, a woman named Naomi, sighed audibly. "The same thing happens to me," she said. "I've been tearing myself up over it for years. When I'm afraid, I just freeze." I had no idea my reaction had a name. I just thought I was a person who couldn't be counted on to think clearly when something scary is going on. Heads nodded throughout the room. The sense of relief in the group was palpable. Knowing that tonic immobility is a physiological response to having one's world turned upside down gave them permission to relax. We talked about how freezing up creates a natural pause, allowing our competing responses to calm down so that we can tune in, think more clearly, and marshal our forces for action. The conversation became animated as person after person recounted situations in which they could have benefited from this knowledge. How reassuring it was to learn that we could follow the lead of the body in handling fearful situation. Your body's truths. Books about mind-body interactions are popular today. We have come to understand that physical illnesses often have messages for us. In fact, our thoughts and emotions affect our health and the way our bodies function. The concept of cellular wisdom takes the mind-body connection to a step further. It invites you to consider that the principles of physiology, the basic biology of the body, contain key truths that you can use to create an authentic, fulfilling life. Cellular wisdom uses these biological principles as a basis for addressing the following questions. How can you make all the components of your life, your body, emotions, psyche, and spirit, function as a harmonious and synchronous whole? The first section of this book looks at the principles that operate within the membranes of a person's individual body, within and between the cells, organs, and organ systems, that keep each of us healthy and functioning with ease and joy. The second section of the book examines the principles that guide our lives as social beings, one-on-one relationships with a partner, family friend, or colleague, interactions with the organizations, companies, and other groups in which people have memberships, and the relationships with the institutions and other systems that impact our lives and community. Cellular wisdom, you will discover, is wisdom written in the body. Lessons for exuberant living are coded into the elegantly complex dance of chemical and energetic interactions, the physiological component of your every thought, word, and deed. You are the scientist of your life. as you explore problems and decisions from the perspectives offered here, you may see alternatives that had not suggested themselves to you previously. If you choose to test these new ways of thinking and acting in your life, you can rest assured, secure in the knowledge that the principles that guide you come from a most reputable source, the truths that your own body teaches.